Radio. Coming up is the news.
Headlines: Iran's president says the ball of reviving the 2015 deal is in U.S. court, adding that Washington must prove it is serious about reaching an agreement. Defying the Western outcry, four eastern and southern Ukrainian regions begin voting on joining Russia. And Britain's University of Cambridge acknowledges that it significantly benefited from the proceeds of slavery over history. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says the United Nations should represent all countries, not just big powers. Raisi was speaking with the UN chief Antonio Guterres on the sidelines of the General Assembly in New York. The Iranian president called on the world body to play a greater role in the face of unilateralism by some countries. He also said the ongoing crisis in certain regional countries must be resolved through national dialogue and without foreign interference. Raisi and Guterres spoke about the 2015 Iran deal as well. The UN chief said the U.S. withdrawal from the accord was an unconstructive move. The Iranian president also spoke about the accord in a press briefing held before his meeting with Guterres. Raisi said the ball is now in a U.S. court in order for the accord to be revived.
We want guarantees from the U.S. due to its past behavior. Washington might suddenly withdraw from a deal that has been signed and refuse to comply with its obligations. This is what we have experienced before.
The Iranian president added that his country wants the U.S. to remain committed to its obligations under a potential deal. Raisi also spoke about the 2020 assassination of top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani by the U.S. He called the killing state terrorism and described General Soleimani as a hero of the war on terror. The Iranian president held a briefing on Thursday, with a day after he addressed the 77th summit of the U.N. General Assembly.
Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi gave his first speech at the United Nations General Assembly, filled with demands for multilateralism, justice, and peaceful logic. Following Iran's official admittance to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization last week, Raisi insisted that there is increasing progress towards cooperative internationalism and away from unilateralism. He decried the choice of capitalism over morality, saying such ideas have lost their legitimacy in public opinion. Raisi spoke of Iran's success in defeating the Daesh terrorist group, called for an end to Israel's 7 decades of ceaseless oppression against Palestinians, and demanded a fair trial and justice for the murderers of Iranian anti-terror hero General Qasem Soleimani in 2020. Raisi said, "The story of the Iranian nation is the story of a nation which stands on its own 2 feet. But the U.S. cannot accept this independence, which explains why, for Washington," Raisi said, "militarism is its security." The Iranian president then continued with more top-level bilateral meetings and also met with a group of analysts, academics, and members of think tanks. No progress appears to have been made this week to restart the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, regarding Iran's nuclear energy program. Iranian negotiations this week with Europe were reportedly tense, as for years, Europe has failed to honestly implement their side of the agreement. Tehran has said that they are willing to revive the 2015 deal, but that Iran needs verifiable guarantees that Washington will not illegally and unilaterally withdraw from the accord again, as it did in May 2018. Ramin Mazahiri, New York City.
Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian accompanied President Raisi in his trip to New York. There, the top diplomat met his Norwegian counterpart. The two discussed several issues, including the JCPOA revival talks. Amir Abdollahian said an agreement is within reach if the United States shows goodwill. He also said the UN nuclear watchdog must distance itself from ambivalent and politicized attitudes towards Iran's peaceful nuclear program. He said the IAEA should act within the scope of its technical duties. The Norwegian foreign minister, for her part, called for the conclusion of an agreement to revive the JCPOA. The two top diplomats talked about expanding Tehran-Oslo cooperation. Political analyst Barry Grossman says it was the U.S. that withdrew from the Iran deal and thus violating the accord, so Tehran has the right to take whatever measure it deems necessary in response.
Even before the ink was dry, and certainly before Iran was in a position to enjoy any of the benefits that it was promised in that treaty, the United States backed out of the deal. And it's like any deal, if you like, that's made on commercial terms. If one party doesn't honor the agreement, the other party's free to make an election about whether to proceed or whether, in fact, to terminate the arrangement and take action against the other party for breaching the agreement. The notion that somehow Iran has been wrong in any of this is really quite absurd. And the notion that the IA should continue to keep its cameras in place and spy on what goes on in Iran, one could presume for ulterior purposes, is absurd.
Iran's intelligence ministry has warned against violent street protests and rioting that erupted following the death of a young woman last Friday. In a statement, the ministry called the people's participation in such gatherings illegal, saying that it could result in judicial prosecution. Earlier, the health ministry said the protests in several cities have disrupted emergency services. It said over 60 ambulances were destroyed or damaged by the rioters, describing the attacks as inhumane. Street violence sparked after a 22-year-old woman died in hospital days after being detained by police. Footages show rioters blocking the streets and vandalizing public property, as well as police vehicles and ambulances. At least two security personnel were also killed while trying to confront the rioters. Riots erupted in several Iranian cities after Mahsa Amini died on Friday when she was taken to hospital. Police released CCTV footage of Amini. The video shows the woman suddenly collapsing on the ground in the police station and then later being brought to an ambulance. Tehran police commander has rejected claims that she was mistreated, saying no physical contact happened between officers and Amini. Officials have been given assurances that a thorough investigation is underway into her death. Political commentator Scott Bennett says Western intelligence services are fomenting the riots in Iran in an attempt to destabilize the country.
The West and the CIA and the Israeli Mossad and the British MI6 are trying desperately to destabilize Iran, to try and foment cover revolutions, to try and foment ethnic strife. They're trying to, by any means necessary, create conflict and division and animosity in order to break Iran apart and exploit those fractures into something that could be used to destabilize and tear the country apart and ultimately rape and pillage Iran and steal its natural resources. So any kind of protest or division should be recognized as a foreign infiltration operation. And the Iranian leadership, the religious leadership, the academic leadership, the political leadership, and the media in Iran should expose and condemn any of these protests as an act of foreign intervention.
People in four Ukrainian regions are voting in referendums on joining Russia. The voting is taking place in Donetsk and Lugansk in the east, as well as Kherson in the south. Polls on Tuesday will close, and the leader of the self-proclaimed Lugansk People's Republic has said that people there have been waiting for this referendum since 2014. Western leaders, however, have strongly criticized the referendums, calling them a sham. Ukraine has rejected them too, calling the vote a farce. Ukrainian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov has condemned the accusations as an attempt to spread Russophobia. He says that it is up to the residents of the four regions to decide if they want to be part of Russia. Russia's President Vladimir Putin has called for a mass mobilization of reservists to serve the army in the Ukraine war. To the West, this has been seen as a move that signals that Russia is in trouble. Putin, however, sees it as another light. He believes this is needed to guard border regions with Ukrainian regions in eastern and southern Ukraine, which recently announced a referendum to become part of Russia.
As the war in Ukraine drags on, Russia announces its intent to intensify its military operation there. President Putin has now announced a partial mobilization of Russia's military forces. Putin said the Defense Ministry had recommended drawing military reservists into active service as the country faces a protracted conflict in Ukraine and Donbas. Putin says the measure is necessary because Russia is fighting, quote, the entire Western military machine in Ukraine. Putin further accused Ukraine of backing away from a deal that was in the making to end the war. After certain compromises were reached, Kiev received a de facto direct order to derail all agreements. More weapons were pumped into Ukraine. The Kiev regime deployed more gangs of international mercenaries and nationalists, military units trained to NATO standards and under de facto command of Western advisers. Putin is referring to negotiations that gained momentum following the start of the war back in February. But the West, headed by the United States, pressured Kiev to quit the talks. The West saw the war as an opportunity to contain Russia. In other words, the United States and its allies capitalized on Moscow's moves in Ukraine to settle their long-running differences with the Kremlin. They then began pouring military hardware into East Europe and Ukraine in particular. The United States has already given billions of dollars of military aid to Ukraine and encouraged the leaders in Ukraine to keep up the fight at the expense of their own people. Ukraine has now turned into a battleground used by the United States and its allies in their fight against Russia.
The referendums are for the four regions of Donetsk, Lugansk, and Kherson. It may indicate a move to annex territories, but it is an assumed fact that those regions will become part of Russia. And as such, Moscow will defend the territories as Russia's own, which would spell another headache for the West and could prove there would be no end in sight to the war.
During his Wednesday speech, President Putin also commented on the upcoming referendums in the two Donbas republics and two regions of Ukraine currently controlled to a large extent by Russian troops. They are putting to a general vote a proposal to ask Moscow to accept them as new parts of the Russian Federation. The polling is scheduled for Friday. Back in February, Russia recognized the two Donbas regions of Luhansk and Donetsk as sovereign republics. However, Kiev lost de facto control of both in 2014 when the local populations rejected the outcome of the Western-backed Maidan coup. But it now appears that they are set to join Russia, which will further increase tensions. It's believed that Russia's partial mobilization is to prepare for the possible fallout of that decision. Back in 2014, Russia took control of the strategic Crimea Peninsula following a referendum there. Ukraine, backed by the West, has made some inroads into the territories held by Russia. Ukraine's counter-offensive has seen the country recapture the first village in Luhansk. They are also making inroads into the Kharkiv region. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky has claimed that the Russian invaders are now in, quote, panic. But Russia has not given any indication that it's prepared to accept Kiev's demands for a full withdrawal from Ukrainian territory, including areas seized in 2014. It now appears that the confrontation between Russia and the West, which practically started since the fall of the Berlin Wall, has entered a new phase. And there are now concerns that the crisis may develop into a nuclear war between the global powers.
The UK University of Cambridge gained, quote, significant benefits from the transatlantic slave trade. That is according to a newly published research investigating the university's historical links to slavery. The research says the university did not directly own slaves or slave plantations, but it gained benefits from the investment by its colleagues in the colleges, that is, in companies involved in slave trading. According to the research, the university graduates, fellows, and benefactors gained wealth from slavery as recently as 1850s. Fees from plantation-owning families are included, too. The University of Cambridge commissioned the research in 2019. Others leading British institutions are conducting similar probes as well. They are reevaluating the central role that slavery had in enriching the country and how they benefited from its injustices. Australia's second largest telecommunications company, Optus, says personal information of almost 10 million of its customers have been taken.
I want to make it clear that that is the absolute worst case scenario. We have reason to believe that the number is actually smaller than that, but we are working through reconstructing exactly what the attackers have received. Importantly, it's a very small subset of data. It does not include any financial details. It does not include passwords. And so when we work through it, we will be identifying specifically which customers and which fields of data and proactively contacting each individual customer with very clear explanations of which of their data has been exposed and potentially taken.
The attack is one of the biggest cybersecurity breaches in Australia. Optus has blamed an offshore base entity for breaking into its database of customer information. Up to 40% of Australia's population may have been affected by the breach. Police and cybersecurity authorities have launched an investigation. A historic military parade was held in the Yemeni capital of Sana'a to commemorate the September 21 revolution in the country. In 2015, Yemeni people protested a Saudi-backed regime and removed it from power. Military officials say this year's parade contains a message to the Saudi-led coalition. And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
A diverse range of programs. Spirituality. Youth. Eastern Tales. Roundtable discussions. Culture. Politics. All produced by IRIB English Radio.
ولقد يسرنا القرآن. path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. Last week, we started explanation of Surah Mujadala, or the Pleader, which is number 58 in the serial order of compilation of the Noble Quran. It was revealed in Medina and mentions the complaints of a woman whose husband had put her away by resorting to the pagan Arab formula known as Zahar, which consists of the words, "You are to me as the back of my mother." This was a pagan custom to imply a kind of divorce that freed the husband from any responsibility for conjugal duties as well as providing support for children, but without allowing the wife the freedom to leave the husband's home or to contract a second marriage. The woman, who along with her husband had become a Muslim, pleaded to the Prophet against this unjust behavior and said she also lacked the means to support her little children. Her prayer to Allah and her plea was accepted. And this brutal and unjust custom of the pagan Arabs was abolished through revelation of this surah, which goes on to state that those who oppose God and the Prophet, or fall to the temptations of the Satan, or lie in their oaths and make intrigues against the Prophet, will be defeated and suffer humiliation both in this world and in the hereafter. While Hezbollah, or the party of Allah, which means those who have firm faith in God, will triumph. We start from where we left you last Friday, and here are ayahs 7 and 8.
أَلَمْ تَرَ أَنَّ اللَّهَ يَعْلَمُ مَا فِي السَّمَاوَاتِ وَمَا فِي الْأَرْضِ مَا يَكُونُ مِنْ نَجْوَى ثَلَاثَةٍ إِلَّا هُوَ رَابِعُهُمْ وَلَا خَمْسَةٍ إِلَّا هُوَ سَادِسُهُمْ وَلَا أَدْنَى مِنْ ذَلِكَ وَلَا أَكْثَرَ إِلَّا هُوَ مَعَهُمْ أَيْنَمَا كَانُوا ثُمَّ يُنَبِّئُهُمْ بِمَا عَمِلُوا يَوْمَ الْقِيَامَةِ إن الله بكل شيء عليم ألم تر إلى الذين نهوا عن النجوى ثم يعودون لما نهوا عنه ويتناجون بالإثم والعدوان ومعصية الرسول وإذا جاءوك حيوك بما لم يحيك به الله ويقولون في أنفسهم لولا يعذبنا الله بما نقول حسبهم جهنم يصلونها فبئس المصير
Have you not regarded that Allah knows whatever is in the heavens and whatever is in the earth? There is no secret talk among any three, but He is their fourth companion, nor, for instance, among five, but He is their sixth, nor less than that, nor more, but He is with them wherever they may be. Then, on the day of resurrection, He will inform them about what they have done. Indeed, Allah has knowledge of all things. Have you not regarded those who were forbidden from secret talks, but again resumed what they had been forbidden from, and hold secret talks with sin and transgression and disobedience to the Prophet? And when they, the Jews and Arab hypocrites, come to you, they greet you with that which Allah never greeted you. And they say to themselves in their hearts, "Why does not Allah punish us for what we say? Thus, let hell suffice them. They shall enter it, and it is an evil destination." If you remember, last week in our explanation of the previous ayahs of this surah, we said, Islam negates irrational customs and superstitions that are in fact oppression in society and prescribes penalties for those who indulge in such abominable practices. Any opposition and obstruction to divine commandments results in misery, both in the transient life of the mortal world and the hereafter. In other words, those belying the prophets are actually belying God and are thus doomed. The ayahs that we recited to you now refer to the omnipresence of Allah at all places with all things and beings. And this includes secret talks as well. Yet, He is not one of any created being, nor is He part and parcel of any event or thing. Usually, secrecy implies distrust, plotting, and evil schemes, all of which are a way of life, greatly liked and practiced by the hypocrites. But as secrecy is a relative term applicable to mortals, it has no effect on the Almighty Creator, as well as on the Prophet of Islam, who, as the best of creation, was always in communion with Allah. Those still in doubt will know the whole truth on the Day of Judgment, when the disbelievers and sinners will be given the record of their misdeeds to see it themselves before being punished. Ayah 8 refers to the events in Medina, where the Muslims, after migration from Mecca and defeating of the battles imposed by the pagan Arabs in alliance with the Israelites, grew in strength, as a result of which the Jews and the Arab hypocrites resorted to duplicity and intrigues by engaging in secret plots against the Prophet, despite being forbidden earlier. They were unaware of the fact that Allah knows everything, including thoughts flashing across minds. The defeated enemies of Islam now started twisting some Arabic words to express their hatred of the Prophet, especially by mispronouncing the greeting of Assalamu alaikum, or peace upon you, as Assalamu alaikum, which means death upon you. They then used to discuss among themselves as to why God is not punishing them for their misdeed, in response to which this ayah means to say that even if no torment has yet afflicted them, the fires of hell from which they will never be able to escape will be sufficient for them. These ayahs teach us that, number one, the Almighty Creator is aware of all things, including our secrets and the thoughts that flash across our minds. Number two, flattery is a sign of hypocrites, and one should not be carried away by empty praises, which are meant to deceive. And number three, when God is the protector, no enemy can harm us. Now let us listen to ayahs 9 and 10 of the same surah.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا إذا تناجيتم فلا تتناجوا بالإثم والعدوان ومعصية الرسول وتناجوا بالبر والتقوى واتقوا الله الذي إليه تحشرون إنما النجوى من الشيطان ليحزن الذين آمنوا وليس بضارهم شيئا إلا بإذن الله وعلى الله فليتوكل المؤمنون.
Oh, you who have faith, when you talk secretly, do not hold secret talks with sin and aggression and disobedience to the Prophet, but talk secretly in a spirit of piety and God-fearing, and be wary of Allah toward whom you will be mustered. Indeed, malicious secret talks are from Satan, that he may upset the faithful. But he cannot harm them in any way except by Allah's leave. And in Allah let the faithful put their trust. It is forbidden to take part in any secret movement to spread evil and terror. But we should work for righteousness with self-restraint. Secret counseling, whispering, and scheming are part of satanic behavior. Believers must heed that when they hold confidential talks, they should not commit sins and disobey God, but their confidential talks should be about good deeds with proper cognition of the commandments of the Almighty Creator. As Ayah 10 means to say, Satan is the source of all malicious words, including secret talks, to try to harm the believers, but he cannot succeed in his plots, unless Allah has forsaken an individual, a group, or a society, either because of their lack of faith or as a trial. Therefore, the believers should firmly put their trust in God Almighty in order to overcome problems and frustrate the designs and stratagems of Satan's followers. From these ayahs, we learn that number one, secret talks are forbidden except to provide security and safeguard one's honor or to prevent the disclosure of some important and sensitive matters. Number two, advice and admonishment ought to be done without publicity in order to have the desired effect. Number three, any word or deed which causes fear or grief in people is from Satan. And number four, the faithful should put their trust in the Almighty Creator against plots and should know that the enemies cannot harm them unless God desires. In conclusion of this week's episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, here is Ayah 11 of Surah Mujadala.
يا أيها الذين آمنوا إذا قيل لكم تفسحوا في المجالس فافسحوا يفسح الله لكم وإذا قيل انشزوا فانشزوا يرفع الله الذين آمنوا منكم والذين أوتوا العلم درجات والله بما تعملون خبير.
O you who have faith, when you are told, make room in sittings, then do make room. Allah will make room for you. And when you are told, rise up, do rise up. Allah will raise those of you who have faith and those who have given knowledge in rank. And Allah is well aware of what you do. At times, meetings are so crowded that those already present must rise up to make room for newcomers, lest there will be no suitable room for them to be seated. This ayah means to say that when people are told to rise, they are supposed to rise without procrastination or annoyance, since newcomers may be very weak owing to their advanced age, or are persons of high respect, in view of which others must make a sacrifice and observe such Islamic precept of etiquette. For instance, when a learned person or scholar enters, we should show respect towards him. Those who observe such selfless manners with sincerity and not with reluctance or outward show will be rewarded in this world as well as in the hereafter, since the Almighty Creator is aware of our intentions. This ayah teaches us that, number one, among the requisites of faith is observance of social etiquette and respect for others. Number two, one should never consider exclusive rights for one's own self at social places. Number three, helping others will result in God's assistance for us. And number four, people of faith and knowledge are held in high esteem in Islamic society.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Described as fury, the report revealed that explosive files showed how Big Oil lied to the public and U.S. Congress about their climate targets. Why does this trend continue, something dating back possibly even decades? Well, in this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at how these big energy companies, while raking in billions of dollars in profits due to high energy prices, continue to dodge and lie about their green responsibilities, all the while endangering the planet even more. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Wael Maydan joins us, Executive Director of the Climate Action Network International from Beirut. Also joining us is Jody Grage, Vice Chair of the Green Party of Washington State, who joins us from Seattle.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Okay, welcome to you both. Let me first start with you, if I may, well, Maydan, and ask you about this revelation, which is supposed to be shocking, based on a report which described it as I mentioned in the intro, explosive files over these large oil companies. However, it's not that shocking, is it? Because it's a repeated scenario. What's your impression when you heard about this?
Sure. First, let me correct one thing. I've changed my position. I'm not anymore the CEO of Cannes International, but just to clarify this, so no, there's no problem. In relation to the topic, no, it wasn't a surprise at all. I mean, we've been always getting information from what the fossil fuel industry thinks and what they say. They knew even before the policymakers in the 80s and even before that CO2 causes global warming, and they tried to hide these facts for a long time. So this is not something new for us as climate activists. We've been working on this issue for a long time on policy, and we knew that this is happening. It's the first time that has been exposed in such a way, in a way that really is creating ripples. And this is important because the last line of defense against fighting climate change is actually this vested interest. Now, working on climate change is not only good for the environment and saving the planet and future generation, but it's good for the economy. It's economically viable. The technology is there. We can solve the problem with existing technology. The only problem is political will, and what's holding this political will is the vested interest of some individuals and some companies, especially the fossil fuel industry. And that's why these few individuals are holding the whole globe hostage. And this is what we need to deal with to actually finally solve the climate change issue.
Okay, well, let's take a look, Jody Grage, at the fact that you're having the way this has been described, and I'd like to get your impression on it, as to whether they're being kind to them when it says internal documents showed companies attempted to distance themselves. Now, do you think that that's the correct way of describing it when you take a look at the history of these oil companies, which we're going to get into who they are?
Well, I think you only have to look at the example of the tobacco companies that lied for decades about smoking causing cancer. And you need to look at all the pharmaceutical companies that were getting rich from the COVID pandemic. I think that the oil companies are simply part of the ranks of the industries that are intent on making as much short-term profit as possible. And, you know, the world and the people in it and the whole system of the earth as it's developed, be damned. So I don't think anyone should be shocked at the continuation of this line of thinking by large industrial complexes.
Okay, let me get your idea, if I may, about what has occurred. Now, based on the reports and how it's been covered, you have a congressional hearing that was held in Washington, D.C. You have an investigation into the role of these companies. And then you have these companies, ExxonMobil, Chevron, Shell, and BP. The House Committee on Oversight and Reform were the ones who did this investigation. And you have the oil companies who testified last year, in which it says that they denied misleading the public. First of all, given the history of these companies, how do you have an investigation into these accusations of which, for sure, they're guilty of, and it takes 1 year before you actually come out with some findings? Now, either these people who are in this investigative committee are trying to portray a different image, or their strong lobby groups, which these companies do have, lobbying some of these congressmen and women and in the U.S. House?
Well, as your other guest said, we have a good example of the tobacco industry. They were able to delay action on tobacco for a long time. And only when those working on the Tobacco Control Convention have been able to include a specific article that prevents the tobacco industry from interfering in tobacco control legislation, when the convention came out and the solution started to happen. And this happened directly when this big scandal came out. Similar to this one, there was this big scandal, and then there was a decision to exclude tobacco industry in putting tobacco control legislation, being involved. Any legislator that gets contacted by the tobacco industry for in relation to tobacco legislation, they have to inform the Tobacco Control Convention Secretariat that they've been contacted to do this and that. So they have to report it. It's illegal for legislators to talk to the tobacco industry in relation to tobacco control. We need something similar for the fossil fuel industry. At the moment, the fossil fuel industry is at the heart of the negotiation. They are in the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. They are talking to legislators. They are talking to leaders. They are talking to everyone about what they want and what they need. They're selling wrong solutions and so on. They need to be outside of conversation because there's a huge conflict of interest. Although Paris was achieved, the Paris Climate Agreement was achieved because there were progressive businesses involved. The business could play a constructive role if they want to. But unfortunately, the fossil fuel, they say they want to do that, but as you can see, they are lying and it's not happening. So this is the problem. I think we need to mirror what happened to the Tobacco Control Convention, to the climate change negotiation, remove them out of the conversation until they prove they really want to solve this problem.
All right. This is the part that we're having, I'm having a problem with, and I'm hoping that other people actually look at it also and question this, Jody Grage. I mean, come on. Isn't there a way that when you have these big, huge, multi-billion-dollar conglomerates make pledges, first of all, that there's a control of some kind, that there's some kind of organization controlling the emissions that they're emitting, number one? And number two, when they make pledges, don't they have deadlines? Don't they have commitments? Don't they have penalties? Don't they have a game plan and somebody who's overseeing this, which we're not seeing neither happening here? Am I correct to question this?
Well, they don't.
No, this is for Jody Grage. I'm sorry. Well, go ahead, Jody Grage. I'll get to you on that. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Jody Grage.
One of the problems is if you're looking at the legislators to do this, it's not going to happen because of the fantastic, ridiculous amount of money that the tobacco industry and the fossil fuel industry and weapons producers and pharmaceutical companies contribute to the legislatures. To think that while all this money comes in, the legislatures are not paying attention to that and are doing what is best for the world as a whole, well, that's at this point a fantasy. So yes, there needs to be legislation. I don't believe it would be easy to get it passed, but why don't we pull in some of these other organizations that are buying the votes to keep doing what they are doing?
Which organizations are buying the folks?
Well, the pharmaceutical companies, the military industrial complex, big business is doing its very best to keep the legislatures on their side and their hold up in Washington, D.C., and they're paying attention to those people, not to their constituents or the condition of the world as a whole. So I think the example of what's been done with the tobacco industry is a good one to follow, and I certainly think the oil companies should be under that same sort of oversight. But, you know, I think there's further room for further development of that concept.
Indeed.
Over.
Well, when we take a look at what the these oil giants have pledged, basically they've relied on unproven technology, as it was reported, and accounting gimmicks, misleading language, in order for them to hide the reality, is how this was described. And then it goes on to say how they're laughing at the people trying to protect the planet while they knowingly work to destroy it. when we take a look at the unproven technology, what does that mean exactly? Is it along the lines of they are sowing doubts, perhaps, as to whether the green energy is going to work or not in terms of preventing the rise in climate temperature, I guess, or global warming, I should say?
Look, first, I think these companies are doing what's in their best interest and what they're doing. At the end, their pledges are voluntary. No one forced these pledges on them. They went forward and said, these are our pledges. So that's why there's no oversight. It's just them taking this initiative to show that they are progressive, to show that they want to engage in this issue, to keep being involved in these discussions, that they're saying that we want to play games, so don't shut us out and so on. They don't want to look bad to the consumer and so on. So that's why they're doing these pledges. They're voluntary. No one can monitoring them. And then they come and say, we're going to solve this by building, let's say, a fossil fuel and attach to it a specific machine that would suck the CO2, you know, carbon capture and storage, and other geoengineering kind of solutions that is unproven technology. Some of it's really dangerous and scary. So there is a solution that exists, but they're trying to find other solutions that would allow them to continue burning fossil fuels as much as they want. So my thinking is that, you know, you're not going to change them that much. There's vested interest. Only their, shareholders maybe can hold them accountable. But reaching that shareholders, we tried and we've worked. A lot of organizations are working on that. It's really hard. In my opinion, they need to be left out of the conversation and work on the demand rather than the supply. If the world adopts 100% renewable energy target, you know, the U.S. did that for the electricity. Most of Europe did that. A lot of more than 150 countries have adopted the 100% renewable energy target. You just remove the demand, then the supply has to follow. And we see it in the electrification of transport. You know, this huge, increase or improvement in the electric car happened in the recent years. Such an improvement because of legislation, because of countries said they want to decarbonize their economy, starting with the transport sector and the electricity sector. Uh-huh. So the car industry, when they saw that there's a huge economic opportunity by switching to electric cars, they went for it. Now we talk to the industry, they tell us, you know, we're ready to switch. Just make sure that the government's prepared all the legislation correctly. And, you know, you have charging stations, everything. We are ready to switch. They are not the bottleneck anymore in terms of switching the transport sector. Of course, in countries like Germany, they still have influence. But, you know, even Mercedes, they're producing a car that can go 1,000 kilometers in one charge. You see what others in Japan and other countries, the industry is ready, and we don't see it as a big problem. The fossil fuel industry is still making, you know, their profits. You look at their profits increasing rather than decreasing from fossil fuels. They don't see the same kind of profit from renewable energy. The minute the economics work for renewable energy more, and this is what the governments can do. The minute governments make more profit from renewable energy, these companies have no choice but to switch.
All right. I'm going to ask you this question before we move on to what is really at the heart of the matter here, at least in terms of the lens that I'm looking at. Jody Graich, it appears when you look at the statements made there by the Oversight Committee, the person that was presenting it, there was a huge billboard behind her of which it said, profits for ExxonMobil, so many billions of dollars. In the case of ExxonMobil, it came in at $17.9 billion for 3 months. BP, roughly around the same, a little more, a little less. Do you think that this is being raised at this point because they are seeing how these big oil and gas companies making so much money, while the rest of the citizens of, for example, in the U.S. may be suffering because of a result of high energy prices, that they want to cap the amount of profits that these companies make or tax them maybe even more because there's an energy crunch and crisis, not only just in the U.S., but pretty much around the world?
Well, there are some considerations that should be mentioned here. One is that the technology that is being developed also has its costs. It has environmental costs from mining. It uses rare materials. The amount of the expense of the materials used and the process used to develop these things is not inconsequential. So part of the conundrum here is if you feel a need to make sure that the companies who are doing the next phase of things beyond the oil industry also continue to make massive quantities of money, the whole solution to climate change then becomes dependent on letting the next technology thing make all this money. But you have limits. The Earth has limits, which we are exceeding as far as population, consumption, the availability of raw materials. So it is not reasonable to think that the only carrot, the only way we have of making companies do the next thing is to enable them to make obscene amounts of money while many people have nothing, just like the oil and gas industry has done. We need to refocus things on a longer term basis, and we need to take away money as the only incentive. Some shareholder groups are trying to do this without an awful lot of success, but we're in a recalibrating point that has to do with the carrying capacity of the Earth.
Well, first of all, when you say that, the recalibrating point, that point was reached on many different COP climate conferences, et cetera. We're going to get to a couple of those conferences, but I'd like to do a history check with you, if I may, and really put the focus on the integrity, the ethics that are involved here, or lack of it, should I say. And the prime example that comes up with is what was called the climate deception dossiers. I don't know if you remember that, going back, some more than decades ago, where the whole purpose of these big oil companies was to deceive people by sowing doubt whether climate change, does it really exist? Is the temperature of the globe, of the Earth really rising? And that was their whole plan, spending millions of dollars to basically promote misinformation. Tell us if we're looking at that to have just prevailed throughout all the years, even now when we hear a report like this come out in the news.
Yeah, again, I said we weren't surprised because we've been seeing it for a long period of time, and actually the fossil fuel industry did succeed. They did succeed in delaying action on the international level, especially, and in the U.S. for a long period of time, and the late 80s, early 90s, the coal industry, U.S. coal industry, if I remember correctly, have trained the Saudi Arabia negotiating team to negotiate in the climate change negotiations to make sure, because you know they had similar interests, which is the fossil fuel economy. But we were able to shift that. Yes, it took us a lot of time. It made us waste a lot of valuable time, and we are now at a stage where we want to do the transformational change faster than before. And you know, in relation to solution, yes, everything has impact. Even us as civil society can have impact in our work. Of course, there should be regulations. It's the regulations from the governments that's going to make the companies adopt correct solutions that don't harm people and planet. We cannot rely on morality. Morality is very subjective. It goes down to the individual. It's not a company. At the end, individuals run these corporations. I've seen some businesses, big businesses, that are more progressive and more inspiring than some civil society organization. So it's just individuals. But just rely on morality and making sure that everyone has this kind of ideology and kind of the way, like, if you want to wait until the planet or the globe, the population on the globe, has this kind of awareness